Welcome to Meet the Writers, a writer of a different sort today. Before any major politician or indeed performer speaks in public, chances are they will have decided on what they're going to say and how they'll say it well in advance. And generally, they'll need help with that. Now, there are legions of people in the background, making sure that those in the public eye don't embarrass themselves when they talk. But few are as sought after or as well connected as my guest today. Mark Edelman, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. It's fantastic to be here. And that's such a nice introduction. I feel like, could you just come with me wherever I go?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what to describe you as a writer, obviously, but also, what, a strategist?
A strategist. I always say there's an expression that some people use at times that's called a fluffer, and it's definitely not what I ever thought I would describe myself growing up or after I went to college, but it's all about getting people ready and prepared and excited, and I do feel like that's what I do on a day-to-day basis. It somehow seems applicable, I guess, to to my life.
Absolutely. Well, listen, let's go right back, because you're a child of Hollywood, really. Your father, well, tell us about your dad.
Yeah, no, I did. I grew up in Los Angeles. My father is a guy named Barry Edelman, who is the executive vice president of Dick Clark Productions, and he, through that, is the executive producer of many show specials, the Golden Globes. He's been the executive producer of the Golden Globes for the last 20 years. They do the big New Year's Eve show in Times Square, which is actually still unbelievably the highest rated New Year's show for going on 40 years now in the United States. He does the American Music Awards. He does the Academy of Country Music Awards. He does a show actually with 19 called So You Think You Can Dance with Brits actually like Nigel Lithgow and Cat Deeley. They do Miss America. I mean, they do a series of different specials. And he grew up in Chicago, and he is a writer first, sort of, and a producer second. And one of the really cool things he did was he was the writer of the author of Elvis Presley's Eulogy. My godfather, who was a guy named Jackie Kahane, was the opening act for Elvis, opened up for Elvis for the last, I think, 7 or 8 years of his life. And when Elvis Presley died, Colonel Parker turned to Jackie and said, "We want you to give the eulogy." And Jackie, in turn, asked my father to write it. So it's one of these really kind of weird things to have in my background. And, you know, it comes up, obviously, when I'm in therapy all the time. You know, so I was around all of that stuff growing up. A lot of my Saturdays and Sundays that I would spend with my dad were in a studio or an edit bay. And, you know, it was kind of a fun way to sort of see life growing up.
Sure, but doesn't set you up necessarily for a life in politics. So how did you end up in Washington, D.C.?
Well, my mom, when I was in high school, would take my sister and I to the San Fernando Valley Democratic headquarters in 1992. And Bill Clinton was the Democratic nominee. And every Friday and Saturday, we would go, and my sister and I would sell buttons and pins. And my voice was, I think, finally deep enough that I could get on the phone and do, you know, sort of telephone calls. And, you know, we would make signs and that kind of stuff. And then after high school and went to college, in the summers, I would go to Washington, D.C., and I interned. I interned for the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which was an organization that elects Democrats to the United States Senate. And it just sort of took. And so after college, I sort of wound up going back to D.C. and sort of worked for various amounts of politicians and entities there. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later, I know. But I always think D.C. and Hollywood, you know, it's the same studio set. It's the same studio, but it's a different set. They're not that far apart from each other.
Now, working on a presidential campaign, when you're not the star performer, when you're a person in the background, it must be quite difficult to move on afterwards. Tell me, from your perspective as a staffer on a campaign, the anatomy of how that works.
Well, you know, it's a great question, because I always laugh that we are somebody who did this. And I worked for a presidential. I worked for Senator John Edwards, who ran for president first in 2004 and subsequently became the vice presidential nominee with John Kerry in the 2004 presidential election. And I always remember people saying to me, and when I started out with him, I was very low level. I was an advanced staffer. I was on the road with Senator Edwards and his wife, Elizabeth Edwards, all the time. I was with them all the time. I mean, they were so sick of me. And what's interesting, when you take a job like that, especially at the beginning, you get really unfettered access to the principals. You're with them all the time. You know, I wound up spending a lot of time at their homes and for Thanksgiving and Christmas and that kind of stuff. And I remember, you know, people would come up to me and they would go, gosh, I just don't know how the senator does it. He's just amazing. I mean, you know, he was in Oklahoma yesterday and he was in Chicago this morning and tonight he's in San Francisco. And how does he do it? And I would say, how does he do it? How do I do it? I would be the one that was worrying about whether, you know, he got everything he needed to do in. You know, he got his meals, he got his exercise in, he had all his briefing materials, but nobody was doing that for me. And I say that in jest because obviously running for president is probably one of the hardest jobs you could ever do. But it takes a lot. It takes a village, to sort of borrow from Hillary Clinton. And, you know, you have all these people that come to work for a candidate and they come for different reasons. Some of them believe in policies that candidate espouses. Some of them believe in the person themselves and their background and where they came from. Some of them may think that this is their horse to get into the White House later on. But, you know, there's no shades of gray. It's very black or white. You are with your candidate. You are with that person. You live and you breathe and you eat and you drink everything that they do. And for those of us that have had the privilege of working on a presidential campaign, it's an unbelievable rigor. There's not a lot of compensation, obviously. The hours are sort of 24/7, and you are, in some cases, sometimes living in supporter housing at times. You wind up living on floors of people's, you know, apartments or houses in states like New Hampshire or Iowa or South Carolina. And it's almost a romance. I mean, you become besotted by this individual and their family and everything that they're about and everything that they do. So as you watch the weeks go by and these polls come out and you're up and you're down and you're down and you're up, it's personal. It becomes very much about your own sort of validity of why you're there and what you're doing. And at some point, people actually vote and they accept it or they reject it. It's very odd to have been, in my experience on a presidential, and we made it when I worked for Senator Edwards, I believe through Super Tuesday in 2004, and it was over. It was done. We lost, I believe, pretty much all the states that night to John Kerry, who became the nominee. And it's all of a sudden a very disarming and alarming experience. Now what? Because you think of nothing but that candidate and your colleagues. And in our case, we were very lucky that Senator Edwards became John Kerry's running mate. And so a group of us got to go right back on the campaign trail about 3 months later. But it's a very strange experience. And you build this relationship with everybody that you're working with that only you understand. And only you can really connect with what everybody's been through. The good and the bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all the little small things that are sort of the things that really bind you all together. Elizabeth Edwards, who has since passed, was a remarkable emissary for John Edwards. In fact, I remember when I would go to North Carolina where they were from and people would talk to me about John and Elizabeth before he ran for the Senate in 1998, people who knew them before. And a lot of times, I guess, when they would talk about people to run for open seats in North Carolina, a lot of them would talk about Elizabeth and not John, which, you know, I think only speaks to how talented and how brilliant she was. And one of the things you do, you know, in presidential campaigns is you have these bus tours that go all around the country, and specifically at the beginning in states like New Hampshire or Iowa, where you go to all the counties and precincts and, you know, it's you're a palpable force on the road. And our bus was called the Real Solutions Express. And I remember Elizabeth Edwards made a songbook. She had, like, her whole life she collected song lyrics. I mean, these are some of the goofy jobs I would have. She said, "You need to go here's the songbook. I need to pick all the songs, and then we need to make copies of them for everybody on the bus. And so I remember going to Kinko's, which is a big copy place in Washington, D.C., and I went with a colleague of mine, Rebecca Waldorf, and we have all the songs, and we're ready to go, and we're, you know, going to copy them, and it's very important. Everything becomes important, even when it seems unimportant. At that level, everything is sort of paramount. And we drop the songbook that we're supposed to copy that she's worked hours on in the middle of M Street in Georgetown. And it was like, I picture it like a Halloween night. It was cold and dark and raining and windy, and you see lyrics of sheets flying everywhere. So it's, you know, these presidential campaigns, they're all encompassing. And it is amazing. You know, again, we saw just this past week in the United States, it was sort of, I think, Super Tuesday 3.0, and Marco Rubio dropped out of his presidential campaign. It suspended it, is, I think, the formal language we use. And, you know, I have compassion for the people that work for him. You know, whether I agree with what they were about or what they're doing or not, even if I agree with him or not, I looked at him and he has four children. He's got a wife. It reminded me of the boss I had who ran for president. I know, you know, what it's like for a family to run for president, what that means, what that looks like, what it does to everybody that works for them. And again, you know, this is your only thing you're doing, really. You can't, it's very hard to get a job on the side when you're working on a presidential campaign. So it's a painful experience when your boss loses. And, you know, like I said, for me, I always thought it was very personal. I just remember when we lost, and it was almost like a miniature death in a sense of, okay, now what? And what about everything we just did for the last, I had worked for him for, I think, 2 years at that point. What about that, you know? And, you know, the flip side is, if you do work for a candidate, and I had this opportunity in a way, who goes from somebody that not a lot of people know, and I would travel, again, with a senator, his wife around the country, and, you know, you could slip into anywhere, and people really didn't know who they were in many cases. And within that 2 years, you have this genesis of that person becoming, you know, in my case, the almost vice president of the United States. I mean, one state in our case in 2004, Ohio, had they voted the other way, John Kerry and John Edwards would have been president and vice president. For me, I saw this up close where you go again from it's him and me in a, you know, some goofy old car driving in whatever city we're in to we had a motorcade, we had Secret Service, we had a plane. It's a really amazing thing to see. And then like Cinderella, when it's over and the ball's done and it's midnight, it's done. The Secret Service bring the candidate home. They wave goodbye. And that's it. It's really amazing.
Now, another category of person that gets that kind of support full on like that is your huge Hollywood star. And that's the other side of your life.
A little bit. Yeah. You know, I lived in Washington for 11 years and I made this decision for personal reasons and just because I felt like I needed to try something different. I went back to LA where I grew up about 2.5 years ago. And it was something I sort of always knew. I mean, there's an old joke that DC is LA for ugly people. And I do always say, like, in Washington, I'm maybe a 7 or an 8, and in LA, I'm maybe a 3 at best, you know? So there is that. You know, I made this reference earlier that it does feel sometimes like we're all on the same studio lot, but you're all in different sets. What I do think is very interesting is that, like Washington, Hollywood, there's no formula. You know, you can get what one might think is the right actor, the right director, the right writer. You know, you can get everything that you think is going to make a winning experience, and it just doesn't go for whatever reason. That's very similar to a presidential campaign or any kind of campaign. If you look back at 2008, before everything started, and you know, in the States, we start these campaigns. I mean, they go on forever. I mean, years. And one, I think, would probably have, if you were a betting man or woman, you probably would have put your money on Hillary Clinton in 2008. She was the name. She was connected. She seemingly had all the people that you would want to make a successful campaign. And the formula seemed to be right, but it wasn't. all of a sudden, this pilot called Barack Obama, as we would say in Hollywood, came out of nowhere, and it met the moment. And the moment, people just sort of, to put it in Hollywood terms, they tuned in, and they couldn't get enough. And that pilot and everybody who was on that pilot became, you know, it's the president of the United States. Everybody that was part of his operation in many ways went to the White House, went into different parts of the administration. They became the long-running series we know as the Obama years now. And, I mean, I remember my dad's office for years was in Burbank, California, right across from NBC and Warner Brothers. And I remember going to lunch with him. There was this restaurant in Burbank called La Scala Presta. And he and I would go, I don't know, maybe, you know, a couple times a month I would go to Burbank and I would have lunch with him. There was this cast that always sort of hung out together. Nobody really knew who they were. There were a couple people that I were familiar faces, but they were by no means big stars at the time. And within probably 4 months of that, we all got to know them as the cast of Friends, you know, which became one of the biggest shows, you know, of all time. It's still in syndication everywhere. It's a great example that you can't bottle that. Sometimes you get it and sometimes you don't. And a lot of it has to do with the time of where the world is and what's going on. Certainly in 2008, I think the world needed Barack Obama. It might be different this time, you know, if he were running in 2016, but it worked. There is this sort of, you know, direct correlation, I think, between the two. You know, I also think that both worlds are very enamored with each other. They both, I think, fancy themselves. Fan is the wrong word, but both are very interested in what the other is doing. Mm. And certainly Washington has a long history. Eleanor Roosevelt, when she was first lady, used to bring in authors and celebrated performers to stay at the White House. Jackie Kennedy, when she was first lady, and famously so, really tried to develop the arts in the White House, bringing in, you know, world-class laureates and poets and Nobel Prize winners. The Reagans were wonderful at this because they were Hollywood. And, you know, during the Reagan administration, it was commonplace to see Frank Sinatra and Cary Grant and Barbara Stanwyck and Lucille Ball. I mean, they were all part of, not in major ways, but they came to Washington quite a bit. My dad did a show years ago called What a Year 1986. It was a special, and it was hosted by Ron Reagan Jr. at the time, who was obviously President Reagan's son. And it was a live show, and my dad, they were doing some pre-tape inserts that they were about to do before the show started. And I was pretty good, as I mentioned. I spent a lot of my childhood in weird ways on these sets, so I was well-behaved in that sense. I knew when not to talk and just to sort of disappear in the background. But I came in, my godfather, Jackie Kahane, the Elvis's opening act, he brought me in, and I saw my dad, and I got very excited, and I said, you know, hey, Dad, how are you? And I sort of ruined the perfect take that they were really working hard to get. And my dad, who is a very, you need to have him on. His stories are amazing. But he's not a yeller. But he yelled at me. You know, he sort of snapped at me in front of everybody. And once they finished all their stuff, Ron Reagan Jr. came over to me and he took me aside and he said, you know, look, sometimes our dads are busy and sometimes they have a lot going on. You know, they forget what's happening in the moment as far as how to make you feel as important as you are. But they still love you and they think you're the greatest. You know, which looking back is a pretty cool story because, you know, here was this guy, the president's son, talking to me, you know, about what our dads think of ourselves. Mm.
Tell us about some specifics. I mean, I know that you've worked with Gina Davis a lot, and she's a person who has got it right, who probably from the benefit of your great advice, but she's doing it the right way.
Yeah, Gina's fantastic. You know, Gina is, and I've just been able, there are opportunities where I've been able to help her sometimes when she came to Washington, just sort of making sure she was meeting some of the right people. And, you know, that was really all it took because she doesn't need any help. But Gina, you know, who is a really fascinating star because, you know, she's an Oscar winner, but she, you know, has had these sort of iconic roles for women, A League of Their Own, you know, as a female baseball player, Thelma and Louise, you know, which is so iconic. it was 25 years ago, I believe, 26 maybe now, when that movie came out. And she played the first woman president in a show called Commander in Chief, which was on ABC. And she has really identified, smartly so, and she has actually more research on this than any other university or think tank in the world about female roles in film and entertainment, television, and the gender discrepancy, and what specifically even in children's programming, what kids look at when they see a male role versus a female role, where a female may want to be a princess or get married. That's it. You know, and she has really taken this research and then taking this to all the studio heads and all the networks and saying, well, why can't that role be a female? Why does it have to be a male? Why does that forensic scientist, like CSI apparently on CBS has been great on this, a lot of their CSI roles are female doctors and forensic scientists. And apparently there is an uptick in universities of this, of women who, you know, want to be in forensic science. And she's very smart. She's been very purposeful. She understands the value of what it means to connect with Washington and even places like the United Nations. You look at Angelina Jolie. She's a great example of somebody who is very purposeful about figuring out how to engage people and make people think about what she cares about. In this case, she's done a lot of work with refugees. She was in Lebanon and she was at a Syrian refugee camp, and it was on the front page of papers all over the world. That's a very powerful tool. And I think Hollywood has gotten much savvier about how to align themselves with causes that are important and what to do to thread the needle to make sure that it's not only increasing awareness, but at the end of the day, you've got to increase funding. You get legislatures on board. You've got to get presidents and prime ministers on board if you really want to make an impact and you really want to make a change.
Sure.
And they're good at that.
I'd like to end by talking about your role in education, because I know that that's something you're also very passionate about.
I do, yeah. A couple things. I get to, one of the projects I work on is with an organization called the Alliance for Climate Education, which is amazing. It's in the Bay Area. You know, the United States, this may be a surprise to you, but we're not all on board necessarily with where the rest of the world is on climate change and climate science. And I work with a guy named Michael Haas, who's amazing. He's a renewable energy guy. And he decided he wanted to create change in students and the way they thought, because these are the people that are going to be voting and actually making policy in a few years. So I help him with this organization that goes into high schools and educates kids on climate science. I'm an advisor on Their World, which is an organization that Gordon Brown and his wife Sarah Brown have started and has been fantastic with education, getting all these refugees, well, really every kid in school. The number of kids that are not in school around the world is mind-blowing. And then you look at acute crises like Syria right now, where you have all these kids that have lost not only their homes, but any sort of ability to be educated. And I've been very excited to be a part of the work that they're doing. And they're really good about getting people to get engaged, to take action, to sign petitions, to get governments to recognize what they're doing and work with all these other different great organizations. I also, Elizabeth Edwards, who I mentioned, who was one of my great people in my life that I got to work for, the Elizabeth Edwards Foundation, one of her legacies was making sure kids have access to just the basic computers and books and printers and everything that you would need now to be a student in the 21st century. And they have a class of fellows every year that they bring in through her named foundation. And it sort of sets them up so they can learn better and then go to school and then to college. Because we see that if you give, obviously, students tools, they're going to really use them. And it changes their lives completely. So it's a mixed bag of stuff that I get to be a part of a little bit. It's really, really neat.
Now, I know that you can't always give specifics about your work and that actually a lot of it is under the radar. But what's next for Mark Edelman?
What is next? Well, you know, I wish I could tell you, and I feel like you could come to therapy with me and we could all work this out together, because I really always thought, you know, my mother always wanted me to be on the Supreme Court. And I, right now, it doesn't look like we're in we're in queue for that. You know, look, I think what I am very good at is sort of bringing disparate groups of people together and figuring out who needs to know each other and making sure there's value on both sides. And I, because I do this sort of hybrid, I called it, you know, a soft move between D.C. and L.A. all the times. It's got to be fun. It's got to be exciting. I always say get excited. It's got to be all of that, but it's got to have purpose. And there's got to be something larger than myself or, you know, any one sort of commercial enterprise, although it's very important that that's involved. I do want to make an impact. I want to add value. One of my favorite stories when I was at the Golden Globes, and I know that sounds very name-droppy, but when I was younger and cuter, I used to be able to help out backstage. And I was in the green room, and I'll just say a very famous actor and I were talking. And this actor had been on many campaigns as a surrogate where Hollywood celebrities go out and they are able to talk on various causes that are important to them to hopefully elect that candidate. And I said to this person, oh my God, you must have loved it. Was it wonderful? Was it amazing? Thinking that I would hear nothing but. And this person said to me, you know, it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. I didn't love it. I wasn't always sure what I was there to do, and I wasn't always sure what I was there to talk about. And it occurred to me that especially actors, part of their job is to take direction for a living. They obviously take it to places no other person can. But I think it reminded me that when you have amazing talent, you still need direction. And you need to be able to push that person to a whatever they're trying to do. And in this case, I'm talking about public service and adding value to, you know, a charity or a cause. They need assistance just as much as I would need assistance if I were going to do something in their world. So I've always thought of that story because, to me, I think it's important to realize that there's a role for somebody like me. I'm not sure what it is. You know, we're all supposed to have an elevator speech by now. I think I'm getting a lot better at it. But, you know, I still sometimes struggle to really say what it is. But I kind of like that in a way because it allows me to do a lot of different things. And I think the future for me will be all of that. And in just in case, I hope you have a guest room. If all else fails, I'll be living with you. So yeah, I'm cognizant of that, too.
Mark Edelman, thank you very much for coming on. Mark Edelman was my guest today on Meet the Writers. Now, you should look out for his work. You won't always recognize it. You won't always know what it is. But believe me, beneath the surface, Mark has probably been there and is influencing what you're hearing.
Thank you so much. This was such a treat. Thanks for having me in.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Claire Urban and Nina Norrick. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.